Thank you very much to my, I guess, older brother. The last time I was in Shabbat for women, I was, I think, Shana Dalit age, and I came for Shabbos, and he, like, you were living in the school then?
Yeah.
And you, like, locked me up in the room for Shabbos, so it's nice to be able to, like, see Shabbat for women. It is a real pleasure to be here. It is a real pleasure to be able to share Torah with you on this either second day of Shavuos or a wonderful Thursday, and really to try and talk about a topic that is, it's controversial. I'm sort of violating one of the first rules in public speaking, which is if you're talking to a crowd that you don't really know, so avoid saying anything remotely controversial. Talk about something neutral. Talk about something that people won't really get offended with. Talk about some like standard and generic idea. I'm not doing that. I'm not really sure why, but we will talk about, is tolerance a Jewish value, the women of the wall and their opposition. I don't know what the official title was. It's probably better when you made it up. Whatever. It is what it is. I couldn't fit it all on the top line of the source sheet. Okay. I'm going to try and do something that is... I'm going to try and cover a lot of ground in a short amount of time. I'm going to try and really relate to several different topics and to do so in a way that hopefully will give us some sort of a feeling, some sort of an understanding of what exactly is going on as far as the women of the wall. I believe some people in the room were there last Friday when it got a little bit wild, I guess would be the term. So, but we'll try and talk about it. We're really going to try and talk about three different issues in a short amount of time. The first thing we're talking about in the narrow sense are the women of the wall, just from a halachic perspective, from a hashkafic perspective, what are different perspectives and how one may relate to them. The second thing we're going to talk about, and depending on your perspectives, either more or less controversial, I guess, depending on where one is from, is the usage of violence to prevent one from sinning. That is a little bit of a controversial... it's not really controversial. No one argues to do it nowadays. But it's a... we'll try to see some of the background of that. And the third is to talk about tolerance from a Jewish perspective. What does tolerance mean? And from a Torah perspective, if we were building the ideal Torah state, what exactly would we tolerate? What would we not tolerate? How exactly does everything fit together? How exactly should we be viewing it? So... the first topic, again, women of the wall. Women of the wall. Feel free to ask questions, by the way. If anyone has any questions, anyone gets offended by anything I say, I'm not really going to be saying anything, I don't think, worthy of offending anyone, in that I'm mostly going to be sharing a range of perspectives, not really my own, much as I'm sure you're interested in knowing what Rabbi Turetsky's little brother thinks. I'll try and share, instead, the words of the Aruch Shulchan and Rav Moshe Feinstein. Okay. Women of the wall. There are really two steps in analyzing the topic of women of the wall, at least from my perspective. Step number one is to assess questions like this from a narrow halachic perspective. What that means is I want to know exactly what's going on. I want to look at sources to tell me, in a narrow sense, whatever is being done, is that okay? Is that not okay? Is it ideal? Is it a mitzvah lecharchila? Is it aser b'di'eved? Is it yahar v'al yahor? I have no idea. I want to go through different sources and see what they are like, in a narrow halachic sense. Then I want to assess it from a broader perspective. Are there larger implications? Are there sociological implications? Are there, and for whatever reason, are there different issues that are going to emerge? Does it matter if someone's doing something, not in the privacy of their own home, but at the kotel? Does it shift a little bit? That's going to be what we're doing in part one, women of the wall. Women of the wall. So I decided to choose the women of the wall. I assume we all know what they are. Is that women of the wall is an organization. They are a group of women that pray at the kotel every Rosh Chodesh. They go with wearing talis. I believe some were tefillin, I think. I was trying to look through the website when I was upstairs to try and get up to date and everything. They read the Torah. As recently as 3 weeks to a month ago, if they did so, they would be arrested at the kotel. Recently, because of a ruling of one of the courts in Israel, they can no longer be arrested. Last Friday, they came to Davin, and that's when there was a lot of opposition. A lot of opposition. So we're going to... one of the things they do is they wear a talis. So what's the halachic status of women wearing talisim? That's the first step. In a narrow halachic sense, how exactly do we view it? We have the words of the Shulchan Aruch, Orachaim Simen Yud Zayin Beis, that's 17:2 for those writing in English. Nashim v'avadim p'turim imnashim yimitvot aseh shazman grama. Okay, so women are p'turos from wearing a talis or wearing tzitzit because it is time dependent. Why is it time dependent?
You can't do it.
I can't do it when? I can't do it at night. So a person wearing tzitzit at night violates prohibition, or they just can't? They don't get a mitzvah if they wear it at night. Okay, great. There's a little bit of a debate whether it's nighttime per se or it is nighttime clothing. Maybe I'm from wearing daytime clothing at night, I still have to. There's a wild opinion that maybe you are chayv to wear them at night if the lights are on in the room. Why would that be? Barisim also, I have to see the tzitzis. So it's not really based on day or night. Maybe it's based on whether I can see them. If the light's on, it says it's safer hapardes, which is a reshown connected to the base medrash of Rashi, that you would have to wear at night. Okay, very nice. Says the Ramah as follows. Normally we assume time-bound mitzvos. Mitzvos asei shazman grammas. We normally assume that if a woman would want to perform a mitzvah asei shazman grammas, that they would undoubtedly be allowed to. That is the main... Anyone argue with that or no? Can I ask questions to the crowd? Is that okay?
Sure.
Anyone argue with that? Okay, I don't think we have any Klosenberger Hasidim here, but other than... You're not from Sanz and Klosenberg, so women in general perform mitzvah asei shazman grammas. Says, however, the Ramah, that even though all else being equal, women are undoubtedly encouraged, it's a great thing to perform mitzvah asei shazman grammas, he says not in regards to tzitzis. Not in regards to tzitzis, so says the Ramah. Why? Ach mechzi ki yura. It looks like yura, yura is, it looks like you're a little bit haughty. Okay? V'lachin einam lovos tzitzis. You can read inside. The Ramah tells us that even though, generally speaking, women are undoubtedly allowed, get those two of these, women are undoubtedly allowed to wear tzitzis, they however should not, says the Ramah, even though women are turos, and normally they're allowed to fulfill all time by mitzvos, here in this context they really should not. That's what the Ramah writes. Comes along the Aruch HaShulchan writes as follows, Aval be'emes lo shamanu zev, emenichan osan livos talis v'kol shekein levara. He says, we've never heard of women wearing a talis. We've never heard of women wearing talises. And therefore, ein menichan osan livos talis. We don't let them. That doesn't, he's not referring to like violence in that perspective. He means like if you're the rabbi of a shul and a person wants to come in, so you would discourage him. He's not, doesn't mean ein menichan, don't let them, like we throw chairs. He means that we just don't encourage or try and stop on some level. That's the opinion of the Aruch HaShulchan. Rav Moshe Feinstein comes along, Rav Moshe Feinstein has a wild, really it's a fascinating tshuva, where Rav Moshe argues that a woman would be allowed to wear a talis under two conditions. Rav Moshe's first condition is that the talis has to be, he points out that Targum Yosef ben Uzziel understands that a talis is a garment normally worn by men, and there's a prohibition for women to wear men's garments, men to wear women's garments, and therefore he says, if women want to wear a talis, it has to look a little bit different. It has to be a female talis. It has to have a little bit of a different style. Colors, but not like the rainbow colors that some men wear, I guess. It would have to be a different kind of colors. I was looking on the internet when I was in my brother's office a second ago. It seems like there are some of the women in the world are makbid for Moshe, some are not. If you look at the talisim, some have like a nice maroon color going on. I guess Tabio would say that. Others don't. Ramosha's second qualification is a fascinating one. Ramosha's second qualification is that women, he says, Ramosha can only wear a talis if it is done l'shem shamayim. If, however, it is not done l'shem shamayim, if it's not done because they want to get close to Ribono Shel'olam, but rather it's because there's a certain amount, says Ramosha, of tar'omes, a certain amount of bitterness towards the rabbis and towards the Ribono Shel'olam, then says Ramosha, they are not allowed to wear a talis. Does that make, we like that or don't like that? That's great? Great. So, just to help me out for a second. The women are wearing the talis because they're upset at God. Is that odd for anyone? If I'm upset at God, I would go eat non-kosher food outside. I probably wouldn't put on a talis, like, despite him. I know, okay. So they're wearing it because they're a little bit bitter and upset, but not to get closer to God. I find that interesting. I find that fascinating. I'm not saying Rav Moshe is wrong. I find that to be a fascinating psychological insight. Maybe people do things sometimes because they're not so... I don't know. Yeah?
Maybe they just feel like mad that they can do it, so they want to do it anyways. Not like, oh, mad at God, they
want to be able to be included. And therefore they're doing it because they have good or bad intentions?
Bad intentions. They're just doing it because, like, oh, why can't we do it? It's not fair.
Okay.
I think it's
okay. That's definitely one possibility. I'm just raising the question. It's an interesting. I'm aware of poskim that mention this. I'm not aware of any poskim that have, you know, argued for giving women a polygraph before they want to put a palace. Like, let's see their intentions. Like, are they really good or not that good? I don't know. Anyway, that's a Moshe's approach. If you look, Jonathan Rosenblum, who is a popular writer for the Jerusalem Post, when he's Jonathan Rosenblum, from Mishpacha magazine, when he's Jonas on Rosenblum, has written about the women of the wall. He has questioned. He has questioned to some extent what exactly their intentions are. Here, we don't really have to rely on a polygraph because Women of the Wall have a fantastic website that tells you what their goals are. And when you read the website, you hear Anat Hoffman, who is the chairperson of Women of the Wall, there it's pretty clear what the intentions are, and you can read there. Just to summarize the first part, and to give some broader context. Number one, we saw that according to the Ramah and the Aruch HaShulchan, the dominant minhag was that women did not wear a talis. This is so, even though normally women are encouraged to perform positive, time-bound mitzvot, suddenly when it comes to this, they're not. We're not exactly sure what's going on, but that's what the Ramah says, that's what the Aruch HaShulchan says. Moshe has certain qualifications. Rav Moshe argues, depending on intent, depending on if it's a different kind of talis, maybe Rav Moshe was somewhat open to it. I don't believe that there are women that wore talisim and MTJ in the Lower East Side where Rav Moshe was the Shiva, but Rav Moshe on some level was open to it. And then, so the question would be as follows. If we wanted to now assess, let's say, should women of the wall wear a talis, we would want to know a couple of things. We want to know, let's say, first of all, how to relate to the fact that the Ramah and the Aruch HaShulchan argue that it's not the minhag. If it's not the minhag, does that mean that the conversation's over, or that means that we can still talk about it? That's one question. I'd want to know Rav Moshe, according to Rav Moshe, okay, so then what are the intentions of the women of the wall? Or are they wearing talisim that are like female talisim, or only wearing male talisim? Those are the questions I would ask if I were Rav Moshe. If I wanted to view it in a broader sense, I would start asking larger questions. Okay, is it just a question of women wearing talis? Is it part of a larger, I'm going to use a word which I, just for lack of a better one, is it part of a larger agenda? Is it part of a, agenda is not always a bad word, it's a motivation for doing things. Are they, like, my agenda in being here is sharing Torah on the second day, on this Thursday. It's not a bad thing, I think. I mean, you'll let me know after. But at least for now, you know, is it part of something larger? Meaning, is it different if a woman would come and tell me that she wants to wear that she's interested in starting to wear a talis in shul, or even at the kotel? Would it be different if she told me that she also wanted to read the Torah? Okay. Would it be different if she told me she wanted to rip down the mechitza in between? Would that be different, or is it not different? Meaning, certain questions from a halachic perspective can be assessed narrowly, and certain questions have to be assessed in it, viewing a larger context. So in assessing women of the wall, it's not my institution. I mean, I think no institution is my institution. But all I'm doing now is throwing in information, trying to raise the questions that we would want to raise if we wanted to assess this question. Majority of poskim tend to assume that because the minhag was not to, that one should not. You can start questioning with Moshe, but the larger questions, that's Adkan, the first section of the shiur, looking at, in general, women of the wall, one narrow halachic question, women wearing a talis, a little bit of a larger question, which is, okay, how do we assess intent? Does it matter intent? Are there larger questions going on in terms of what's really behind the motivations? Okay, that is that for the first section. Any questions, or we're okay? Yes?
Is there a mosque that's seder talis?
I think both is the assumption.
So when it says
Tzitzis
and
Talis, yeah, are used. Yeah, usually like Talis Gadol and Talis Katan are the two way that's referred to in halachic sources. And Tzitzis, you know, also refers to both. It's really, I think, refers to the strings. Yes?
The second condition of Rav Moshe is that it needs to be the intention of getting closer to God. But what would Rav Moshe say about, like, let's say, I don't know in what condition this would be, but a man's intent on wearing a talis. Like, does a man still get a mitzvah wearing a talis?
That is a fantastic point, noted by a very prominent Dayan in America. I think it's a fantastic point. I don't know, but I think it's a great point. Nothing to say other than, normally we don't tell people not to do mitzvahs because we're concerned about their intention. Normally the Gemara tells them, Pesachim and Daf Nun, that we encourage people to do things shelo lishma, lest they come, so that they will come to do it lishma. Where Moshe is coming from is fascinating. Rav Soloveitchik has a very similar approach, possibly, depending on how you learn a story in about the Rav, but not for now. We're trying to move a little bit. Okay. What? So when? 15? I can go less. I can go, what?
I don't.
Whatever you tell me to do is fine. The whole room's looking at you right now.
I don't think anyone would complain if you ended at
5. If I ended now, am I the best year in the...
No, if you ended now, you know.
If I ended now, it's like, that was unbelievable. Okay, next. Violence. Violence to stop people from sinning. Okay, that was what was done a little bit last week.
Although no one would be upset if he ended at 5:15, no one would be upset if the development of your idea went a bit beyond that.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, I'm not sensitive, it's okay. You know, like, I'm fine.
Okay. People seem to be enjoying your lecture.
Okay, no, I got it. Well, now, thank you for the positive encouragement.
I wrote it before.
Yeah. It's the first time I've gotten it, but it is. Okay. Sorry, I'm going to stop right now. Okay. I'll go to the less heated thing about using violence to stop people from sinning. Okay. This happens to be a little bit interesting. Last Friday, what happened was, and if you follow the news enough or you read the right websites, I guess, stuff like this happens unfortunately fairly often, which is that a group of people from a particular segment of society, it's not a majority of any society, it's a small group, that believes that one is supposed to use violence to stop people from sinning. That was, if you follow the news, the wonderful Sfarim store, Manny's, in Mei Sha'arim. There was a time last year, I think, it was in the news, where this group was throwing things through the windows of Manny's. They were, using violence to do some really horrible things. Because they were selling some Sfarim that this group was uncomfortable with. So there is a group out there that maintains. What happened last Friday at the Kotel, people throwing water, coffee, chairs. Never seen that. Garbage, sure. I think sometimes they throw diapers is the... I mean, I guess. I have a good joke, but I'm not going to say it. But that's normally what... there are those who do that. There are those who do that. The question is, where exactly does that come from? And I guess I'll formulate the question as, how wrong is that? It happens to be, which is a little bit of a scary thing. If you look at the Gemara Baba Kama on Chaf Ches, Amud Aleph 28a, you would find the Gemara does, at least according to Rashi there, seem to refer to some sort of violence being used, some sort of physical action that's being used to stop them from sinning. If you look in the Sefer Chinuch and Taf Tzadi Aleph, Sefer Chinuch is a book that was written. It's one of the Rishonim counted the 613 mitzvos. Many of them did. Many have the practice Shavuos night to read through. In the times of the Rishonim, there were Rabbanim that wrote long poems. Sadiq Olam, Rav Shlomo Ibn Gabriel, they wrote long poems counting the 613 mitzvos. Many of the practice Shavuos night to stay up all night reading those poems. I don't know how they do it, but that's what they do. Shavuos night, 613. Sefer Chinuch is also a count of the 613 mitzvos. It was written, he says, for his son. We don't know exactly who the author is, but it was written for his son because someone's wasting a little bit too much time on Shabbos. What better way to get his son back on the derech than write a sefer called Sefer Chinuch? Okay. I don't know if we should do that if our own children are going off. I don't know if, like, time to write the sefer is the right move, but I guess, whatever. For him, it worked. Sefer Chinuch follows. V'yishlanu limo mizeh sha'afa pi she'enanu hayom ba'avron sefer smuchem. Because nowadays we don't have formal smicha. Smicha, to become a rabbi in the Talmudic sense, in the real halachic sense, was passed down from Moshe Rabbeinu all to Yehoshua. It was passed all the way down. That chain, that ended, and now the smicha that we have nowadays is not, strictly speaking from a halachic perspective, smicha. Rather, it's just essentially rishus, permission from one's rabbeim to paskin to answer halachic questions. So Sefer Chinuch notes that nowadays we have no smicha. Nevertheless, he says as follows: Sheyesh lekol kahal v'kahal, every community, every group, shebechol makom limnos beinayim ktsas min hatovim shebahem sheyelahem koach al kulam. We should appoint who are like the best people in the room. Choose five or six of them. You guys are now in charge to do what? Lahachuicham bechol minei hecherich, to force others with all types of force, sheyira be'ineihem, bimamon, o afilu biguf, whether that's with money, whether that's a financial penalty, or even if it's physical, alasiyas mitzvos haTorah v'limnoa mikirbam kol davar miguna v'chol hadome elo, and to prevent people sinning or doing, and a little bit of kol davar miguna, anything which you find a little bit distasteful, anything that one is just really. That the Tovim, every group, let's say for a chinuch, should establish, let's get a couple of people to be in charge, they're going to enforce that everyone sort of is keeping mitzvahs, not violating averus. They are like the hall monitors that happen, I don't know if that happens outside of like TV and movies, but the hall monitors, the people who are going to be in charge to make sure people follow exactly what is going on. The Ramah in Shulchan Aruch, the Ramah, Ashkenazi Psak, we're coming from the Ramah even writes as follows. If you have control over someone, that's basically Gemara Baba Kama that refers to if one owns a slave, another controversial topic, I guess we'll just throw out there. The Roe Boshu Ose Dover Avera, Rashai Lahakoso Liasho Pilafrisham Yisr. I'm allowed to hit that person to stop them from violating Yisurim. Wow. It's pretty like. Very like religious, I guess. Are we comfortable with that or uncomfortable? Anyone really comfortable with that? Like, I found my mitzvah? Anyone like, no? In the boys' school, when I was talking about this, we're like, yeah? The Ramah? The Gemara Baba Kama on Chaf Chas is pretty clear. Yeah. On some level. Also, the Gemara is talking about a couple Gemaras. Can I ask a question? Just so I can look in. Okay, great. I'm gonna like look somewhere else. Then. The Gemara Baba Kama talks about one who is stopping their slave from stealing. There's also Gemara in Ksubis on Daf Pei Vav 86a for those that again. Anyone typing in English or it's only no? But most of you are Yontif. Great. Yeah. You should not be typing in Yontif. Okay. Not Yontif. Typing is a fantastic thing to do. So Gemara there also talks about when forcing someone to be Mekayim a mitzvah. The Gemara there on Pei Vav and Aleph in Ksubis. Okay. Nevertheless, we have the following that emerges. Hold on a second. There is not a posek on record, to my knowledge, nowadays that encourages one to use violence to stop people from sinning. The Sefer Bina Vidas, about 5 or so years ago, there were 2 svarim printed on. This is unbelievable. 2 svarim printed on the same topic. What? Both about the status of non-religious Jews. One was called Re'acha Kamocha, published by Rav Avram Wasserman, who's a rabbi in the Hezder Yeshiva in Ramat Gan. One, written by a Rav Binyamin Adler called Bina Vidas, they have opposite conclusions. Re'acha Kamocha is a book all about how Jews who aren't religious have to understand where they're coming from. They're halakhically in the category of Tinok Shenishba. They're not really held accountable. If they weren't aware of a Torah approach, it's very inclusive. Bina Vidas is arguing that that's not really true anymore. We really shouldn't consider them to be Tinok Shenishbas. It's a little bit of a harsher approach towards non-religious Jews, even in Bina Vidas. Lemaisa bismanenu yesh lehimnam bechal ofen shal afrasha bekoach meister klabi osam elish enam shomrei mitzvos. Bisman hazeh. Let me just reiterate that so that bisman hazeh. We do not have poskim on record, to my knowledge, who argue that one is allowed to use force to stop someone from sinning. Okay, why not? What happened? The Chaznish has a very, the beginning of Yoredeya is discussion about Hilchos Shechita. The Chaznish decided in the beginning there, Hilchos Shechita tells a lot about non-religious Jews, and there one of the things he says is, he says that they're all in the category of Tinoch Nishba, they're not really held accountable for their actions, and the Chaznish says nowadays we never use force, we don't do a host of different things, says the Chaznish as follows, V'kevin shekol atzmeinu l'takin. Our goal is to fix, our goal is to bring people back. That whole halacha about forcibly stopping someone from sinning only applies in a time when that was an effective tool. The way that we're supposed to bring people back is through love. The way that we bring people back is through positive support, through trying to reflect a certain positive approach. That is the approach of the Chazon Ish. So to summarize part number 2, we saw violence, the water-throwing opposition, is that the name of the title, something like that?
Yeah.
Great. So that, there are, if you look through the Sefer Chinuch, and you look through the Ramah, you would say, oh, maybe not that bad. In Halacha in general, if you stop sometimes in the 16th century, so we're not always up to date with, you know, more recent developments, Bizman Hazeh, we assume, believe Shum Safik, without a shadow of a doubt that a person is not supposed to use violence, stop people from sinning. So now we have two groups. We have women of the wall on the one hand, we have those that are using violence stop on the other hand. Yes? Yeah.
So how do you like
those? I'm trying to think if I want to answer that question. I definitely want to answer the question. I'm trying to think how to answer that question in a the rules of, I'll say this. The rules of when exactly this can be, I hope I'm not a bad thing, it's not controversial. I'll say it as follows. The rules of when a person is and is not obligated for wounding a fellow Jew are a little bit more complex than one would think. I'll throw out a power of example. Going paintballing. Paintballing. You know, someone goes paintballing and they get wounded here. So is that considered to be, have they violated a prohibition or not?
Yes.
Some say yes and some say no. It's a discussion. What it relates to a little bit, if I can throw out a source instead of the Rambam in the 5th chapter of Hilchos Chova L'Mazik is where you have a discussion about that. In the beginning, you read about two things. The kind of person you're hitting and also the method in which you hit. If it's done in a grip, yeah, so when we start defining those terms, let's say the same way no one would say if a person's chayv malchus and someone gives him lashes, that person who's giving the lashes violates a prohibition. If they give too many, it's actually the source for not being allowed to hit another person. But okay, fine. We saw, yeah.
Is the intention of the people throwing the water to get the women to stop sinning, or is it just to, like, get them out of the
without an intention? Okay, first of all, I do not know how logical. I don't know what they're thinking. I don't think they would really talk to me if I asked them. Like, I'm giving a shear on you, and like, why you're wrong. Like, what exactly? I don't know what their motivating factor is. It's a good question. I don't know what their motivating factor is. I don't know if they. It could be. I assume they think that if they do it, they will win at the end of the day. The women will stop coming. No one wants to come somewhere with chairs are being thrown at them. That's a principle. I assume, meaning, I would stop coming to hotel if I was getting something thrown at me.
Right.
I guess.
You're not going to be provocative.
Sorry, I don't want to say that. I don't know if that's true. But I'm assuming that that's their logic. We'll talk in a second about the value of protests. We'll talk about it in 1 second. Yeah. Oh yeah, totally. Yeah, no, I assume mob mentality is a big moving factor in what a lot of people do for things. Yeah. Could be why you're all here, I don't know. You know? Hopefully not, but okay. Sorry, is that okay? Say that? Whatever. Okay. As the air gets turned off. Yeah. Let's move on. Protests and tolerance. Sorry, mind if we okay. Protests and tolerance. Okay, so now let's say I'm going to start with two assumptions now. Both of these assumptions, I think, one possibly could question. But two assumptions. I'm going to start with the assumption that using violence on top of sitting is not allowed nowadays. I think it's a solid assumption. I'm going to now assume something else only for purposes of continuing the shiur. I'm going to assume that everything the women of the wall want to do, that at least part of it is not ideal and should not be done. I'm going to assume that. Let's say, a woman wearing a talis tefillin reading a Torah at the kotel with the goal of taking down the mechitza is not ideal. That's my assumption. Could one question that assumption? I think there are, I mean, women of the wall do. That's going to be my assumption. I want to now know, so now what is the, how do we resolve that? What should be done? What should be done? What are perspectives out there? If you were in charge of the kotel, what would you do now? You're in charge of the kotel. You're the rabbi of the kotel. What do you do? You think what the women of the world want, you're uncomfortable with. You don't want them doing it. You certainly don't want violence. So you are a leader in Klal Yisrael, or you are the one of the people who is running the women of the world. What do you want to have happen? So I want to talk about protesting for 1 second. A brief comment. Protesting, and talk about tolerance. In the Sefer Riacha Kamocha, which we referenced before, the one that's very inclusive, Rav Avraham Wasserman writes that he does not really understand any halachic value to protesting. He doesn't see any halachic value to it. There may be practical value in a certain sense. I'm sure many of us, for sure those from the New York area, have participated in, like, usually like once a year or so, there's some protest at the UN, like Ahmadinejad is speaking, there's something going on. We believe that there is some function of... Maybe the different guys came to throw stuff? Is that... we assume that there is hopefully some political value as far as protesting, but we do not, religious value, he views that there's not. There are others who have argued that there is some religious value to protesting in a calm way, if one disputes something. When argued with what's going on, they protest in a calm way. Why is that? It's based on a comment of the Sefer Yerayim. The Yerayim is also one of the Rishonim who counts the 613 mitzvos. There are a lot. There are a lot of different Rishonim that counted. In the times of the Rishonim, it was like, I guess, like a fun thing to do or something they found beneficial. They counted the 613. The Vilna Gaon did not, because he found it not to be a beneficial thing to do. Why does it matter what's in the 613? Okay. The Sefer Yerayim, when he counts the mitzvah of tochacha, the mitzvah of rebuke, to say the Yerayim writes that the mitzvah of rebuke applies even if the person I'm rebuking will not listen to me. Even if they won't listen, I still have to protest. Based on that, Rav Yaakov Ariel, who may be the future Ashkenazi Chief Rabbi, in the back of Riacha Kamocha, and has a Ha'ara there, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, as well, has suggested that there are two functions to the mitzvah of rebuke. Function number one is to get the person to stop sinning. However, the Urayim is adding an additional level. You know why sometimes I have to protest? Not for the other person, but rather for me. Meaning, I am not allowed to stand idly by and remain apathetic in the face of sin. I'm not allowed to stand by quietly while someone is sinning. So if I would perceive that someone is sinning, I have an obligation to protest. It doesn't necessarily involve violence, but that's part of the question. Is there a function of protest from a halachic or religious perspective? From a political perspective, you can bring in someone that knows a lot more about politics than me. But from a religious perspective, it would hinge on this Urayim. Is there a function of protesting when it's not going to impact the other person? So when a car drives by on Shabbos, and someone says, Shabbos, or Shabbat, something like that, the function of that is not to stop the person from sinning. It's so that I remind myself about the uniqueness of Shabbos. And that's why I do it. I imagine if I'm throwing rocks and trying to get a person to stop sinning, that's not to like give myself even extra chizuk. But that the function and goal of some form of even a token protest is that I don't remain apathetic. That's why I think you saw at the Kotel last week a different approach. It's one that I happen to think is much more... it's undoubtedly much more in line with a Torah outlook, which was the approach that Rav Steinman from B'nai Brak gave his backing to, which was to have lots of students in the Beis Yaakov movement to go and daven at the Kotel Friday morning, daven peacefully, with the condition that no violence is allowed, but that there are going to be women of the wall there, so we should also have representation, and we should also, he was saying, his community should go there and daven quietly. That is a... whether that's halachically valuable or not, that's a shiloh, within the Urayim. Whether there's any toilets, okay, that's a calmer form of protest. That's something which I assume many of us would have a little bit of an easier time relating to. What about tolerance in general? Tolerance in general. Is tolerance a Jewish value? Are we a tolerant people? Any thoughts? Someone who didn't read the sources on the back page?
No.
Are we tolerant people?
No.
No. What? Okay, so I have to rebuke. Is rebuke a... Okay, so if I give rebuke, that means I'm not tolerant? What does tolerance mean? Acceptance? If I give you the right to be wrong, is that called tolerance? I give you the right to be wrong. I believe that's how I believe President Richard Joel of Yeshiva University is fond of calling himself a pluralist, because he believes everyone has the right to be wrong. Is that tolerant or not? Yeah.
I think tolerance is when you have a line.
Okay.
And you accept other people, but then until that boundary, until that line, and then you just
don't cross that line. Okay, so let's even say it like that. Maybe the Torah approach is somewhat complex. Maybe we believe that there are boundaries and there is a line, and that's a line that we can't really cross. Okay, but within there's some room. There's some room.
Can't be passed.
No one goes to the Kotel and says you have to daven Nesach Ashkenaz. No one says you have to daven Nesach Sfarad, unless you're Rav Yosef, and then you hold that every Jew that comes to Israel has to daven Nesach Sfarad, but Chazanish argued, so other than that, no one says that. So you have to, on some level, okay, so tolerance is somewhat complex. What about when I say, let's even sort of a couple ideas of the definitions of tolerance, this is where the Torah perspective gets a little bit more complex. Like Dr. Moshe Sokol, I think he's now with Turo, in case that makes anyone feel comfortable at this quarter, which is all from YU, so now we're even. Although I think, yeah, since I think came out all the time on the sheet I learned in YU, I don't know if we're totally even, but Dr. Sokol writes as follows. We have to distinguish between two forms of tolerance. He says historically the word tolerance meant something different than how we use it nowadays. Historically the word tolerance meant, it was asked by the people in charge, do they tolerate? Do they let the people under them do certain things? So for example, I would have the question as a parent, do I let my child do certain things on Shabbos? Do I tolerate it? Do I tolerate my daughter, who is 2.5 years old, to play with muktzah things on Shabbos? Do I let her do it? Normally, nowadays, when we speak about am I tolerant or not, we're not talking about whether or not I'm going to stop someone from doing it. When you ask me, sorry, are you tolerant of the things going on in your surroundings, I'm not in control of stopping it. Tolerance usually nowadays means, do I think they have the right to do what they're doing? Do I think they have that right? Do I think they have that right? Those are two different conversations. Two different conversations. Would I stop them? And then even when I'm not in a position to stop them, do I respect them? Do I give them that choice? Do I think that they should have that choice? How do I approach them? How do I look at them? That's one distinction. Just something to think about. In America, usually we're talking about the second category of tolerance. We're talking about, in America, we're not establishing a government. In a societal level in America, we speak about tolerance. Again, just me, my tolerant person, I'm asking the question of, do I give them the right, do I respect their right to decide whatever they want to do? In Israel, where we have a government, that is, this is an important point to clarify. Unlike, let's say, America, where there's a separation of church and state, there is no separation of church and state in Israel. There is no separation of church and state in Israel. The two are intertwined. Which means that in Israel, part of the question we're asking, even on a societal, on a mass level, is what do we think is okay? The first definition, what do we tolerate? What do we let people do? That becomes a question from a halakhic perspective, and that's a complicated one. Rav Lichtenstein goes on to describe tolerance at length. And Rav Lichtenstein writes as follows. First, he points out it's a complex topic, but not because it's hard to find the sources. You can find the sources fairly easily. Look in the mitzvah of Tochacha, Lo Samar Adam Reyacha, in the 10 seconds after I asked the question, are we tolerant? People threw out the two or three main places to find the discussion. We know where the sources are. What don't we know as much? What's the struggle? Why is it hard for us? Well, it's hard for us because many of us, myself included, many of us experience a certain tension. Because when I read through those psukim and I learn those halachas, the Torah's perspective on tolerance is just, it's different than America's. I'm an American. I made Aliyah August 1st. I'm living in Israel for 6 months. I am a, I don't know, 8 months, whatever it is. Someone's doing the math right now. Maybe you all are. Second time I mentioned what year they're born, and like the whole room you see like start looking up and like trying to figure it out. You know, like, I mean, I had 1972 when I was 18, and I was like, two, you know, like, those kinds of things. Yeah. I don't think I really cared how many months ago I moved to Israel, though. If you do, there's a great staff here in Shalva for women that you can talk to. In America, we really believe in personal freedom. Personal freedom. I'm sorry, I'm not referencing Canada or England. I just don't really, it's not totally clear to me as far as how that goes. I have in my shiur in Shalva for men, I have citizens, I had others here, five different countries. So it's like hard to keep track, so I just, you know, I'm good with America, my wife is from Montreal, so I'm okay there, and I'm learning more about England. But apologize to the Australians in the group, that I just don't know that much about what goes on there. Okay, but it's different. We tolerate a whole lot in America. Personal freedom, separation of church and state, nobody can tell you how to worship God. You can worship him the way that you want to worship him, assuming there's no personal, there's no harm that's caused as a result. That's much more complicated. But all else being equal, you have the right to worship as you want. From a Torah perspective, that is not true. And Aaron talks about how for many of us, we experience tension. Tension that I would argue, and many of us would argue also, doesn't stem from like the external Western influence corrupting our minds, but rather even internal halakhic values, internal Torah values. We believe in respect. We believe in a certain amount of personal autonomy. We believe that I'm not going to go around and I'm going to give people some space. So we do have that. Nevertheless, the Torah's perspective is somewhat more complex. And we really do not really allow certain things. We really don't allow everything. So when we want to know if we were the leaders of the Jewish people, Bezrat Hashem and another, I don't know, now. We should all be zochah to be at that point. But if we were the leaders' people, we were in charge of the kotel, how do we handle the issue? Step one is just the recognition that the Torah perspective is different than the American perspective. For better or for worse, I mean, I would say it's great that the Torah is what it is. It's the reality that we deal with. It's the perspective that we deal with. No, what's the Torah perspective? And there are going to be a host of different questions. Well, how usher is it? I stop everything? Do I stop every single thing going on that I'm opposed to? Is it like a sefer achina? Anything that I find to be davar meguna, I find it not to be to my... It's disgusting, it's not to my taste, I have to stop it? Is that what we're arguing for? Does it have to be a violation of a clear pasuk? Davar hamifurash bakra, an explicit source in the Torah? What exactly is the line? It's a complicated question. What's it going to hinge on? It's going to hinge on how you view the first section of the shiur we gave today. It will be dependent on that. What's the halachic status? If it's really wrong, so we're not going to tolerate it. If there are certain instances where it's okay, so for sure I'm going to tolerate it. That's going to be part of the discussion. Rav Aaron goes on to explain another distinction within the world of tolerance. And this is one where it's fascinating. Sorry, I'm using both. This one, you know, doesn't play to my Tversky height as well. You know, I'm like, fair. I can get a chair here, a stool, and I'm good to go. Rav points out that Rav Kook and Rav Soloveitchik seem to have different approaches in regards to an additional distinction within two kinds of tolerance. He points out the word tolerance denotes a mindset and an attitude. Toleration, a course of action. There are two different questions. There's a question of how open am I intellectually? What am I interested in reading about and learning about? Am I interested in incorporating a very wide range of ideas? Or am I, in the end of the day, I come to my conclusion and I stick with that conclusion? That's an intellectual question. Rav Aaron says the word tolerant, when we use it, often is something intellectual, similar to what Dr. Sokol said. It's a question of, how do I relate to it intellectually? How am I as an intellectual? Am I broad? Do I incorporate a variety of different perspectives and different ideas? Or do I, in the end of the day, come to one firm and one approach that I really believe to be true? There's another question on the public policy level. On the public policy level, so then how much do I then take whatever my view is and assume everyone else has to follow it? Rav Aaron argues that, with certain exceptions, Rav Kook and the Rav and Rav Soloveitchik were in opposite directions. Can you write the Rav? Yeah? I was in ninth grade in TBC, and Rabbi Adler, who's the head of TBC, is a Talmud of Soloveitchik, Talmud of the Rav, and he really is a big believer in the. He really likes the Rav. So there are probably many people here giving one day because of him. No? Is that possible? So Rabbi Adler, I remember someone's giving a shiur and he's quoting the Rav, and like one of the guys raised a hand and said, "This, like the Rav you're quoting, is that like Rav that's in the Gemara? Like, who are you talking about?" And he was just like, "I don't even know where to begin." You know what I'm saying? Like, there was like God, and then there was Moshe, and then there was the Rambam, and then there was the Rav. You know, like that kind of like, okay. So the Rav and Rav Kook have opposite approaches. Rav Kook, as an intellectual, was open to a very wide variety of ideas and different perspectives. That's why when you want to pin down the approach of Rav Kook on any given topic, it is often very hard to. He was a little bit more of a poet. He wrote as sort of a free-flowing emotional style. It's a little bit challenging to always pin down Rav Kook. He was very broad and open to a variety of different things. Practically, as a manhig in Klal Yisrael, Rav Kook was a little bit more narrow. I don't want a movie theater open on Shabbos. I don't want certain things to be going on. Rav Kook, practically, when it came to implementing public policy, was a little more narrow. Rav Soloveitchik was, said Rav Aharon, really the opposite. Obviously, the Rav was exceptionally broad intellectually. But when the Rav came to an approach, the Rav came to the approach he thought was totally correct. The Rav was someone who had a firm approach to a topic, obviously utilizing a wide variety of sources. But as a leader of Klal Yisrael, the Rav tolerated a lot more. The Rav was much more open to people, to quote the Richard Joel line, to people having the right to be wrong from his perspective, for people to make certain decisions, a personal autonomy. So you do have a little bit of a range as far as within tolerance. Let's summarize the third section, offer one or two concluding remarks. The third section, we saw tolerance. We saw different definitions of tolerance. Tolerance, I'm in control, I stop you. Tolerance, I respect your right. Tolerance, as far as intellectually, how broad I am to different ideas, how open I am to them. Tolerance, toleration, what Aaron's referring to is on a public policy level. What are my rights? What do I have the options in terms of what I can do? We saw that the Torah perspective is somewhat different than the perspective that at least the majority of us came from, which is one where many of us come from a society which believes in a certain version of freedom and personal autonomy. You can worship God however you want in the United States of America. That is not as true in a purely halakhic state. We spoke about how for some of us who are uncomfortable with that may be because we have an internal halakhic, we experience certain tension. Let's just conclude with two thoughts, in particular about the issue at hand, women of the wall and the Kotel. Two thoughts at hand, two things that make it unique, one from Rav Shmuel Rabinovich. Sorry, I'm going to conclude with three things. I was at a speech yesterday where the guy was supposed to be for 12 minutes, and he started saying, "I have one more point," 22 minutes in, and his fourth, "I'm going to finish," 33 minutes later, convinced me yesterday, I was accountable upon myself to try and never say, you know, I'm two more points and then keep on going for another like 45 minutes. So, 3 points. After three, if anything else comes into my head, I'm going to stop. I'm adding a footnote. I'm going to review at the end what I spoke about. That's a footnote. That's what we call a loophole in my decision not to say more than three things. But that's the plan. Three things. One, Rav Shmuel Rabinovich, the Rav of the Kotel. Point that an additional factor. I find this to be fascinating. The Kotel is a place of achdus. He therefore argues, because the place of achdus, we should not let the women of the wall daven there. Right? That's counterintuitive at first. Place of achdus means I should let everybody daven there. Sometimes, this is a nuanced idea, it's just an important principle. Sometimes, achdus, to keep and maintain real achdus, require saying no to certain people. That's a tragic thing, but sometimes that's unnecessary. It could be that to let them go there, the Kotel would be a mess every Friday, the Kotel would be crazy, it would be wild, it would really undo the current state of the Kotel, where people come and are able to daven peacefully, and right now it functions nicely. Rabinovich writes, the walls of the Kotel, those walls, those bricks, remember very well the price of fighting within Klal Yisrael. Those bricks know what happens when Klal Yisrael fights. Maybe that means everyone has to compromise a little bit, but he says sometimes to keep the current state, which is one where people come and it functions nicely, sometimes say no. That's at least a thought, an interesting thing to think about. Something interesting to think about. You can take it or leave it, but something interesting to think about. Rav Yuval Sherlo, the Rosh Hashiva, the head of the Yeshiva in Petah Tikva, although I believe they moved recently to Renana, so we'll call him Petah Tikva, and probably no one's going to call me out on that anyway. Yuval Sherlo pointed out as follows. That the Kotel has always served. The Makom HaMikdash has always served two functions. Function number one is a place, Ki'ir Shechubra LeYachdav, is a place of Achdas where all of Klal Yisrael, and really Kibesi based Tefillah the Chol HaAmim, where everyone's always felt welcome. It is also the Makom HaMikdash, which means that the laws are not set by us, the laws are set by the Ribono Shel Olam. There's a tension. We want the Mikdash, we want the Kotel to be both. A place where everyone feels comfortable, but also, that's part of its legacy. Avas Chinam, it's a place where we want there to be everyone feeling like they have access, like they have a certain right. But also it's the Mikdash. It means that we follow Torah, we follow Halacha. It's a place where the Ribono Shel Olam tells what to do. So Rav Sherlo highlights another point of tension. Point number one was Rabinovich, the question of unity. Question number two was that of Rav Sherlo, how we balance that tension between wanting everyone to feel comfortable, but also wanting certain to know that we have priorities and we have values. So Rav Sherlo says, how are we going to manage that? So maybe Nathan Sharansky had a plan. Let's build a third area a little bit further down, and that area is where the women of the wall can go and they can wear talis, tefillin, and read the Torah. Rav Rabinovich, the head of the Kotel, said, I'm not going to endorse that plan, but I'm not going to fight it. Meaning, I'm going to tolerate it. I'm not going to fight it. I don't have to agree with everything I tolerate. Maybe that's another idea, says Rav Sherlo, another perspective. A third thought. Never mind, I'll conclude and then add a third thought. That footnote was after the second thought. Here. Adding it in. We saw the following. We saw three discussions. We saw a discussion about women of the wall. We saw a certain methodology and how to approach those issues. The narrow halachic question. So we chose talis. Okay, what's halachic status? Okay, we then saw broader issues, the role of intent and questions like that. That is for many postgame a critical factor. For others, they have to be much less comfortable with that. That's for women of the wall. We then saw using violence to protest it. Okay, not okay? Not okay. We then saw number three, we saw tolerance. We saw different definitions of tolerance, difference between stopping someone, the tension between how a Torah state would really look, and also how in contrast to the world that at least I am much more just naturally comfortable in that the American society. We then add a couple concluding points as far as the Kotel goes, the point of unity, a thought to think about, the tension between wanting everyone to be welcome and wanting to be Makom HaMikdash. Just to end, with the powerful words of Rav Kook. The powerful words of Rav Kook, HaTzadikim HaTahorim. What's really our real goal at the end of the day is we have to look beyond this particular issue. Our real goal, the truly righteous, says Rav Kook, their goal in life is not to add darkness, but to increase light. It is not to. We add righteousness. The real goal of what we're supposed to be doing in this world, maybe sometimes it's appropriate to protest, maybe not, depending on the context. But the real goal we have, the overarching principle is, we want to do whatever we can to bring more light into this world, to bring more light. A light that is an Or Chadash, a new light that can come, that emerges from the Torah, to bring people like the Chazan Ish said that we saw. What we do nowadays is that we're Mosif Ava. We bring people back through love, and we hope that it's an Ava that we can use for all of Klal Yisrael, to unite Klal Yisrael. So the topics that we're talking about now, that are topics that are exceptionally heated and controversial, can be fascinating from an academic perspective, but we hope that from a Klal Yisrael perspective, that we're zocha to a greater sense of clarity, that we're zocha to a time when we just really feel the light of the Ribono Shel Olam. Shavuos is the time when we go to the Makom HaMikdash. We should be zocha. The Makom HaMikdash should be a place, Ki'ir Shechubra LeYachdav, where everyone is comfortable, Or Chadash, Al Tzion Ta'ir, that we should be zocha, that light that hopefully we will add can shine on the Makom HaMikdash. Thank you very much. Have a great day. Yeah.